You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. My life in Dire Straits, the inside story of one of the biggest bands in rock. Dire Straits filled giant stadiums around the world and sold hundreds of millions of records throughout the 80s. They were one of the biggest bands on the planet, starting with his own unlikely beginnings in Middle England. John Isley, he recounts the band's rise from humble origins in London's spit and sawdust pubs up until Madison Square Garden. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. John himself. John, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Are you well?
I'm very well, thank you, all things being considered. And lovely to see you again, because as I just said, we haven't seen each other since the Kempinski exhibition, which was, blimey, a couple of years ago now.
Oh, it's a bit more than that, I think, I'm afraid to tell you. But the last 2 years seem to have drifted into obscurity for reasons we all know about. I got a feeling it was probably 4 years ago.
Oh, well, you know, we luckily we've kept our boyish good looks ever since then anyway, John, so that's the main thing.
Well, some of us did.
tell us about then, you know, we know the state. I mean, basically, it's the soundtrack to the 80s, isn't it? It's the soundtrack to the 70s and 80s, all the way from Telegraph Road, you know, Sultans of Swing, through to Money for Nothing, I Want My MTV. I remember distinctly what I was doing during the 80s, because Dire Straits was the backing track to most of it.
Well, yes, and I suppose that's really the reason why I found myself going back in time and trying to relive those moments and kind of understand them a bit better than I did, and I found it quite a cathartic exhibition of memory, and I enjoyed the process actually of trying to figure it all out and try and put it in perspective, because it tells you where you are now from where you were before, and Yeah, it was good. It was quite a cleansing moment, actually, I have to say. I enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed doing it more than I thought I would, which is always good. It's always a good thing.
I mean, for those who maybe don't know the background and maybe just came across Sultans of Swing sort of burst onto the music scene, what was it, 78, 79? Yeah. But what were the beginnings? I mean, how did you start getting an interest in playing, you know, the noble bass, and also how did you meet up with the other band members?
Well, I found myself in Middle England, which is where the story starts, in a very safe and secure, slightly Victorian approach to life, with parents who'd both been through the war, and so they wanted a safe and secure world for their children, like everybody did who'd come back from that horrendous experience. So it was a very safe household, but it wasn't very emotionally active, if you like. That side of things was lacking. And I think that music spoke to me in a certain kind of way. And I think it speaks to everybody in a certain kind of way. With me, it went quite deep. And that depth of music has stayed with me, really, all those years. And so I just found myself wanting to get involved in playing the guitar and playing along to these songs that I heard on this simple little radio that my brother built for us. And that was the start of a sort of a love affair, really, with the whole thing. And as I say, it hasn't really gone away.
I mean, who were your early influences then, listening on that homemade wireless? I mean, because I've always thought, Dire Straits, listening to the early stuff, it's very... There's a definite instance of jazz. It's thinking music. It's not going up and hitting sort of three power chords and then just going, let's rock, is it?
No, I think there were four on occasion. Ah. Well, I'll tell you something interesting about that. The majority of a lot of great songs are incredibly simple in their chord structures. As you know, you listen to music all the time, and I think Sultans is probably five. I can't remember now. Five chords, is it? Five chords? Yeah, something like that. So, you know, it's amazing what you can do with very little. But the early influences are what probably people like Elvis and Chuck Berry and B.B. King and people like that who were the things that was the American music that was coming down through that crystal wireless set, you know, in 1963 or something, whatever it was, 63, 64. which of course, you know, we didn't know anything about Elvis in those days. A few people did, but you had to find, you had to get albums shipped over or singles shipped over from America. There wasn't, Elvis was pretty much unknown over this side of the water to a degree. And so it was a big eye opener. I mean, I remember those Sun sessions very well, you know, from that Elvis did when he was about 17 or 18 with Scotty Moore, people like that. And that's amazingly fresh. And it was a whole different way of making music. You could not fail to be not excited by it, I didn't think. But, do you know, I realize that people get things out of music which other people don't get. They just, to me, it's the background of my world, and to you, of course, because that's your world too. But for some people, it's just, oh, I like that song. Oh, I don't like that one. And they, oh, can you dance to it? You know, so, which is all fine. And I, you know, and then some people are completely obsessed with it. So it's all a matter of degree, really.
And so when did you sort of decide that you were going to start playing with other people? When did you decide that, you know, I really want to do this to the exclusion of everything else? Because growing up, obviously, as you said, in a sort of quasi-Victorian environment, surely yeah. being a musician was that something that your parents encouraged and thought was a good thing? Or did you want you to go into accountancy, for example, or something like that?
I think they wanted me to get a safe job, but I wasn't quite sure what that meant because... They tolerated the noise that my brother and I were making on guitars. They tolerated it because at that point in time we couldn't afford anything, so we were literally making amplifiers and making speakers and putting together whatever we could. So it probably sounded horrendous, I should imagine, but they kind of put up with it, thinking, oh well, they'll grow out of it, I suppose. I didn't grow out of it. My brother slightly did, but he went down another artistic route. He became a painter and a sculptor and a potter, actually, a very good potter. So, you know, I just carried this thing with me and they sort of tolerated it. But I think they were worried that I was going to, you know, fall short of having a safe life. So I did actually get a job, as I say in the book, with this timber yard for 3 years. And... I suppose you could say that was the one only time when I worked for a living.
So how, I mean, was it very much, because again, people won't know the story, was Dire Straits literally sort of your first proper band, as opposed to those sort of like back of the village hall, you know, in the garage rehearsing sort of bands that we've all sort of like thrashed around with?
You can't knock those early experiences.
Oh, no.
They all take you in the direction that you're hopefully going to end up in. Of course, you never know when these things are going to, when these things take off. Nobody does. You just do it because you love doing it. And you've got to love doing it because you don't get any money for doing it. I mean, obviously, money comes a bit later if you're successful, which is all very nice. Hence the song Money for Nothing.
But yeah.
In the early days, we just did it literally for fun. You know, and I've played in a lot of different kinds of bands over the years, you know, blues bands, soul bands. I never really got into jazz that much. That'll have to come later in life, I think, when I've grown up. Well, it's very grown up music, isn't it, jazz? It doesn't really move me in the way that rock and roll moves me.
But it's interesting you say that because of, you know, like I say, some of the tracks that you've put down on some of the early albums were, Telegraph Road is 11 minutes long, if I remember correctly. So, you know, would you say that's not got jazz leanings to it, John?
I don't think the length of a song's got anything to do with jazz, has it? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that the closest we came to it was probably Your Latest Trick.
Right. Yeah.
That's got some interesting chord shapes in it. And I think that's probably as close as we got to it. I know Mark's very attracted to jazz at the moment, partly because he just can't stop himself from looking at different kinds of music. I spoke to him about it the other day, actually. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm dabbling with a bit of jazz. And I went, oh, okay. So you better watch out for the next Mark Knopfler album and see what's...
if he's wearing a beret on the top and he's got, you know, a cigarette in hand and a saxophone in the background, we can all be worried.
Well, so, there won't be a cigarette in his hand, I don't think. He's giving up the smokes, that's yeah. for sure.
So, I mean, when did you first meet Mark? Was it a case of, you know, you knew he was around and you thought, well, we better get together with him? And did you meet him in London? I mean, whereabouts did you guys first actually hook up?
Well, I met him in the council flat, which I was renting from the local council, because I was at Goldsmiths College studying sociology, and I managed to get this council flat. And David Manoffler was my flatmate, and Mark came down, you know, to meet David, and obviously met me. And I don't know. I as soon as I met him, I thought, I'm going to know this bloke for a long time. So I got that right, and there was a sort of warmth about him, that sort of that Geordie warmth. I don't know whether you can remember that sort of northern approach, very quiet, sort of gentle kind of person. And I just took to him straight away, and then discovered, of course, that he was a fantastic guitar player, even then, although he's developed into something else now, but, you know, which has taken into another arena altogether. But we met in this simple little flat. I went to play with his band that he was playing in then, called the Cafe Racers. I did a couple of gigs with them, and we'd been thrashing around on just with a few ideas in the flat. And we were just sitting in the pub one day, you know, after one of these gigs with Cafe Racers, which was a sort of rockabilly band. He didn't sing in it; he just played the guitar. And he just turned to me and he said, "Why don't we get a band of our own together? Because I've got a few songs that are bubbling away, and I'd already heard Sultans, and and I said, "Yeah, why not? Let's give it a run."
You already heard Sultans. At that stage, did you think to yourself, this could be the one that takes us, you know, brings us fame, fortune, and money for nothing?
No, well, the early version of Sultans bears absolutely no resemblance to the one that everybody knows. And I kind of vaguely remember it was slightly country sort of feel to it. And he can't remember either, because I asked him the other day. I said, "Do you remember?" He said, "No, I completely forgot." Because you didn't have any way of recording it. Like, we've got iPhones now, which we can record everything on.
Yeah.
Every second of the day of our lives. And then you had to sort of remember stuff. Well, he can't remember it, and neither can I. And I think, you know, what I heard was probably that early one. So Sultans was around as an idea, but it didn't become a reality until he bought himself that red Stratocaster. That sort of changed everything. Just the sort of the whole feel of the thing changed. And I remember coming home from college one day, because I was just finishing off my degree when I met him, and he said, I think I've got that Sultans thing sorted out. And he played it to me, and I think you have. So I picked up the bass and started playing along with him. And the first thing I did was exactly what you've pretty much got on the record now. It was just instinctual, the way I played it. But so, you know, sort of magical moments, which I just really wanted to try and reflect on and share with people, because it was a hell of a ride. I mean, it was a hell of a journey. Some of those moments came back to me. And I think I got most of them down, but I've obviously quite a lot of forgotten. But I think if I'd remembered everything, it would be about, I don't know, 1,000 pages long or something ridiculous.
The Tome of John. Just, I mean, we talk about playing in those spit and sawdust pubs. I'm thinking about the London pub scene, like the mid-70s, and it was Dr. Feelgood, Nine Below Zero, Kilburn and the High Roads. How did you guys fit into that sort of situation?
Well, we were all sort of, you know, not punk bands, but we were just music bands. I mean, Kilburn and the High Roads with Ian Drury, of course, before he did the Blockheads thing. Dust on the Needle was another band. That was a great name for a band, that. The Feel Goods. Yeah, I mean, Graham Parker and the Rumour. If you look at those old posters from that time in the mid, late 70s, it was all those bands playing. And we sort of shared the same stages for a while. The punk thing was going on in another sort of space, I felt. I didn't really feel connected to it at all. It was sort of going on, and I thought, that's kind of interesting. They don't seem to like anybody or anything. I thought, well, I quite enjoy my life, and they don't. They seem to hate everything. I mean, I don't know what. I thought, well, you know, it was kind of weird. These two things running, the pub bands and then the punk bands. But we did play. I remember we played one gig with, because we were on the road with Talking Heads, if you remember rightly. And I don't know whether you saw that tour, but it was a 2-week university tour with Talking Heads. And we ended up doing the Roundhouse at the end of it. And the bill reads Talking Heads at the top, Slaughtering the Dogs in the middle, and Dire Straits at the bottom, right? So we were at the bottom of this. So we went on first, and thankfully the audience, it was full, it was absolutely packed. The audience was divided into three tribes, the Dire Straits tribe, the Slaughter of the Dogs tribe, and the Heads tribe. So we went on first, thank God, because the spitting didn't start until Slaughter of the Dogs went on. It was a real eye-opener. We got off on the stage, and the Slaughter of the Dogs came on, and literally the audience just threw beer at them, spit it at them, threw things at them. I thought, oh my God, this is just a war zone here. And of course, then the Heads had to go on after that. And there was, you know, there was nasty things all over the stage. And I remember David, you know, the singer of the Heads, David Burns, looking at the microphone going, oh my God, it's covered in spit.
Yes.
The days.
Look back fondly. I mean, were you prepared for sort of the success that Sultans would be? Because that launched you. I remember that coming on the airwaves, you know, in the late 70s and being absolutely everywhere. And from that point onwards, you know, it was, as Hunter S. Thompson said, buy the ticket, take the ride.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we really expected anything from that record, apart from the fact that obviously the record company people got very excited about it because they used to listen to Charlie Gillett's Sunday show, and Charlie used to play new music all the time, and he really went for Sultans in a big way, and he played it every Sunday, so it was difficult to ignore it. Until he said, I'm playing this song until one of these record companies picks this band up. And he was a man of his word, and we ended up getting a record deal with Phonogram, and you know, on off we went. But we had to learn a lot of things quite quickly because, you know, the our world was changing very rapidly. Suddenly, we were still living in the council flat, and we had a number four album in the charts in America. I mean, what's that all about? We didn't have time to move. We were so busy.
Yeah.
We didn't have time to move flats. And it was kind of weird going back to that after being in the States.
And then you then go off to the States and you're playing, you become very, very successful. And as you said, from a council estate, it wasn't as if you'd been doing 10 years with Dire Straits before. I mean, how was that? Because very few British bands crack America, but it's safe to say that Dire Straits not only cracked it, but turned it inside out and made a rather nice souffle out of it.
Yeah, I think one has to thank the Beatles for awakening the Americans to British music. A lot of bands just never cracked it in the States, and they were perfectly good. I mean, Cliff Richard never sort of cracked it for some reason or another. Anyway, but going to the States was a real eye-opener because I think the promoter over there was, we did this tour, we did 51 shows in 38 days or something like that. So you do double shows in places. They change the audience over after about an hour and a half, and you do about 3 hours playing a night, which sharpens your game up, I've got to tell you. And the promoter, of course, wanted to move all the venues that we'd already sold out to somewhere bigger. And I think that would have been a bad move because, you know, it meant that there was a hell of a buzz about the band, you know, at places like the Bottom Line and the Roxy in LA and such like. These are sort of iconic venues like the Marquee Club, you know, in London was. And the Roundhouse is iconic, I think, as well. So, yes, it was a sharp learning curve, I have to tell you, you know, dealing with all that.
And at the same time, as we go into the 80s, MTV comes on the scene, and that changes an awful lot. And that suddenly, even more so. And if you weren't around at the time, I mean, I was like a teen, I was in my late teens, when MTV first burst onto the scene. And suddenly everybody, I mean, we would spend literally, much to our parents' disgust, days, we'd have MTV parties where we just watched MTV because it was so new and fresh and amazing. And the Money for Nothing video, although now it looks ridiculous, it looks quaint, but at the time it was groundbreaking. And I'm not just talking about, and also, I'll just give a quick note, my mate Jason Raven could mime to the drum solo like nobody else.
Wow. that takes a lot of doing.
Indeed.
Because that was a one-off. I don't think he ever repeated it. yes, well, Brothers came out at a particular point in the music world when CDs suddenly hit the planet and MTV came over to Europe. So it was a sort of, like, to use a sting word, synchronicity was in the air. And so you have MTV coming on stream, you have CD coming out. And actually, I was talking to somebody this morning, I don't know whether this is an apocryphal story, but apparently there were more CDs out in the marketplace than there were CD players at one point.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because they couldn't keep up with demand. It was an interesting period. But I don't think, ironically, the Americans didn't really get the tone of Money for Nothing, because it was really taking the mickey out of the whole thing, it was a magical time, I have to say.
To a couple of things. I mean, what's it like then going from playing your marquees, your small clubs, to playing doing world tours? I mean, you were doing proper world tours. I mean, what sort of demand and playing huge venues? What sort of demands does that put on you as a group of friends and as a musician? If it's Thursday, this must be Tokyo. But also, do you actually sort of stop and think, this is getting a bit insane. We were in a council flat a couple of months ago, and now here we are, overlooking the bright lights of downtown, downtown Seoul.
Well, it wasn't quite as rapid as that, thankfully, or else I think we'd probably be dead by now. But it did happen quickly. But by the time we were doing those massive tours, the Brothers in Arms tour and the On Every Street tour, we'd done quite a lot of other work, around the world. And I think we got better at doing it. We did it in a way that worked for us. I think to use the word disciplined is probably accurate, because we were quite disciplined about getting it right and making sure that every concert that we played was a good one. Mm. And you can only do that if you've done a lot of rehearsing. I mean, we used to painfully rehearse till your fingers almost bled, So by the time you hit the stage, you were running at full tilt running at that particular point. You didn't have to work yourself into the tour. And I think we became known as a pretty good live band. And I used to love it. I absolutely loved playing live, especially in all size places. The Hope and Anchor, to the Marquee Club, to Madison Square Garden. With Billy Joel on piano. I mean, if you pinch yourself, you think, what's going on here? Or Bob Dylan, coming onto the stage with us in Melbourne and playing a few songs. And by the way, he did change the key before he came on stage, so he confused us all a bit. But
Talking about playing live, one of the 1985, one of the seismic occasions in music history, Live Aid, and you were involved in that, and everybody's got a Live Aid story, and it must have been chaotic, fun. You've put it down in the book, obviously, but any memories you can share with us of that particular day? Because again, the whole world stopped and watched on that day, because there had never been anything like it.
Well, it was an incredible thing to pull off. Let's be honest. I mean, I think Bob was very frustrated when he first had the idea, because he couldn't get anybody to agree to do it until, a big name agreed to do it. And we were a big name then, to be frank. He said, I effing insist you play Live Aid. Well, we had already had 12 nights booked out solid at the arena next door. So we said, well, the only way we can play is in the afternoon. So anyway, that set the precedent. So he could go out to other bands and says, Dire Straits are playing. So then a whole lot of other people agreed to play. And so these things, they, you know, it takes one person to say yes, and then everybody else wants to join the party, of course. And then there was almost no room for everybody who wanted to play. So it was an incredible experience. But the funniest part about it was we did a sort of sound check at the checked all the equipment at the arena, walked across the car park to go to the Wembley Stadium car park. Went backstage. We were there for literally 15 minutes chatting to a few people, went on stage, played Sultans and Money for Nothing. And it all went down well, thankfully. And then we came off stage, 15 minutes chatting to a few other people, had a couple of beers, and then walked back across the car park to go to the Wembley Arena and do a sound check. Well, the thing is, when we got to the arena, the security guy at the back of the arena said, what are you doing here? Where do you think you're going, sort of thing? And we said, well, we're the band. He said, where's your passes? So we had difficulty getting back into the arena after we'd done the stage. It was almost surreal. And then he suddenly went, oh, yeah, of course. All right. What we used to call Jobsworths, you know.
Yeah, indeed.
It's not worth my job to let you in.
Obviously, Dire Straits aren't out there now touring. You know, you haven't done the whole Rolling Stone stroke Who thing. I mean, when did you decide that, you know, you wanted to sort of wind it down a bit? And I know kind of what you're up to now, apart from writing this book. So when was it, do you think, you know, we've had the run, let's scale it down a bit?
I think it was good to leave it on high, which was at the end of that tour in 1992. I think we thought, you know, Mark and I certainly thought that we'd kind of done enough with that particular vehicle. And, you know, 7 million people we played to on that tour.
Wow.
Which is ridiculous. And I think we were physically and mentally completely exhausted. I just wanted to put the bass guitar away and not look at it for 6 months. And I didn't. I said, I'm now going to be a painter. Oh yeah, you're going to be a painter, are you? So anyway, that was another journey. So I mean, that's what I've been doing really ever since, you know, painting and still playing music, you know, on my own terms, which is fine. I'm very happy with that.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the book being cathartic. I mean, was it good fun to go back and revisit and remember and perhaps rediscover? Because some of it you probably, as the saying goes, if you can remember it, you weren't really there. Now I know Dire Straits are disciplined, so they probably did remember most of it. But yeah. You know, those little gigs and those small experiences.
Well, I think that it was a very happy thing to do and a great thing to do, but I had to relive also those times which weren't so great, you know, with relationship breaks down and such like, and that was very, very hard, very, very tough. It was tough when David left the band. It was tough when Pick left the band, because I'd formed a real kind of unit with Pick. But you know, it's a tough life. It's a fantastic life, but you know, it's a sort of, there's lots of different levels in it. You know, there's the joy and there's the sadness, and there's the exhaustion and the elation. I mean, you get all of that in a life like that, and I tried to get that into the book so people could understand what it was like. And you have to sacrifice a lot for this thing. But in the end, I can't be more happy with my life after all that.
If you pick out a high watermark, you know, a bit where you go, yeah, you looked around and went, this is probably as good as it bleep, 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 bleep gets. is it doing, you know, doing those first gigs, you know, like, is it, you know, saying to David Byrne, don't go too near that microphone? Is it appearing, you know, not, is it getting let back into Wembley Arena after walking off stage at Wembley Stadium? What would you say was the, or is it, you know, as you said, having just a massive hit albums like Brothers in Arms, for example?
Well, I think that, you know, we were in America in 1980, six when we were doing that tour around the States, which was phenomenal because of the Brothers in Arms and Money for Nothing and stuff. And, you know, our manager, Ed Bicknell, walked into the room and he said, "Okay, guys, you want to hear the good news and the good news?" And we went, "Yeah, that sounds all right." And he said, "Well, you're number one in the album charts and you're number one in the singles charts. It don't get much better than that."
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And just another quick question. The headbands. Tell me about the headbands, the sweatbands. I remember bright headbands, and I think we were all wearing them at some point in due deference and respect to the great Dire Straits.
Well, it started actually when we were playing the clubs in London, because it was so hot, even in the winter, because these places were crammed with people. There was no air conditioning. And the lights you used in those days were these very old things called power cans, which sometimes the temperature on stage was getting close to sort of 45 degrees. I mean, it was unbelievably hot. And Mark literally couldn't see what he was doing. So he put the headband on one night and put these things around his, because basically if you've got sweat running down your hands onto your guitar, it's, you know, and so it turned out to be it was a practical thing. Which then just became a bit of a talisman for a while, you know, and that's the way it was. And, you know, people sort of reflect, you know, that you do. So it's funny when you go on stage, you play night after night after night, you basically prepare your uniform for the show. It's a bit like being in a Shakespearean play. You know, you put on the clothes that you feel comfortable with, or that you know that you've got to wear in order to feel that, you know, you good about when you go on the stage, and it's simple as that, you know. And for him, it was the headband, you know.
Well,
it's simple as that. He doesn't wear one now, by the way.
Well, thank you for the headbands. Thank you for the memories as well, and thank you for the brilliant music. I will never forget hearing Money for Nothing for the first time at full pelt on a CD and just going, "What is that?" and watching the video as well. The book is called My Life in Dire Straits, the inside story of one of the biggest bands in rock. It's by John Ilsley, who we'll be talking to today. John, if people want to find out more about you or about your artwork, because that's what we were talking about before, where can they find you, my friend?
Well, johnilsley.com, or on Instagram, I think it's John Ilsley Music or something like that. I'm not very good at this stuff. Thankfully, I've got somebody who knows about that kind of thing. But I think this lady that's handling it now is doing a good job of getting it all out there. So I've got websites and Facebooks and all that stuff, I believe. So,
well, track it down. The book is called My Life in Dire Straits. It's by John Ilsley, who we've been speaking to today. John, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Nice to see you again, man. Okay. We'll meet again, I'm sure.
I'm sure we will.